And welcome to Historians of the Movies podcast. I am your host and creator, Jason Herbert, and every single week we are bringing you movies and the histories behind them. And this week, and for the next several weeks that follow, we are talking about all things Franklin, the new series on Apple TV. We're going to be recapping these episodes, talking each single week. And this episode today is going to be covering episodes 1 through 3 of the new Franklin series on Apple TV. If you are familiar with the HATM podcast and the other series that we have done, Masters of the Air, this episode and this series will operate just like it, with a couple little tweaks. With this series, I've recruited a permanent guest host that you're going to meet in just a moment, Kelsa Pelletier, who's going to introduce herself in just a moment. And then we're going to have a rotating cast of characters that jump in, so you have a new historian or two every single week talking about this series. So, without further ado, welcome to Franklin on HATM Podcast. Our guest host, Kelsa Pelletier. Kelsa, you want to introduce yourself and tell us like what you're doing here?
Thanks for having me, Jason. My name's Kelsa Pelletier. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Mississippi, and my research is on Benjamin Franklin in France. So I'm very attuned to the subject material for this series, and my research looks at the relationship between friendship, gender, and honor in early American diplomacy, and uses Benjamin Franklin as like a case study to look at all these things. So friendship, gender, honor, and all these things are like playing out in the series, and that's why I am here.
You're so awesome. Much into France that he made your last name French.
I know.
Well,
I
actually, it's mainly Italian, meaning leather worker. It has a French spelling because supposedly from a family changing it down the road after immigration, supposedly.
Don't feel bad, Jason. We've all
Frankified. No, do not feel bad. It has a French spelling, but someone changed it down the road at some point in the family. But it is Italian.
Listen, but I'm an Americanist. French, so you're not. I don't care about France or Italy. All I care about is America land. Anyway, I grew up in Louisiana. My last name was Hebert for a time. So that's fine. Let's talk to a guy whose name I probably won't mispronounce. Craig Bruce Smith. Craig, who are you? We are honored to see you here. What are you doing here?
I'm the reigning, defending, undisputed champion of number of times being on the HATM podcast. I don't know what appearance this is. You keep bringing me back because clearly you know you're inside. You are wrong about all your views. So Craig Bruce Smith, associate professor of history, author of American Honor, the creation of the nation's ideals during the revolutionary era. So I focus a lot on, on the American Revolution, on the founding, on the big founders. My book focused on Washington, Franklin, Adams, and Jefferson. But if we're putting a rank order, there is a correct answer.
Mm-hmm. I just seen a white guy in
the book. Again, like I always say here, I have to say all views are my own. Not that I'm going to say anything particularly inflammatory.
It's early. Give it a couple weeks. You might. Let's give it some time. Well, you know, this is Craig's only appearance on this particular podcast. And by the way, we have actually someone has actually usurped Craig's lifelong record. It would be Sarah Perry Myers, who has been on every one of the Masters of the Air podcasts. So if you count each one of those, Sarah owns the record.
But does that just count as one?
I don't know. She's had a lot of airtime. Okay. We'll debate this a little.
And Kelsa's going to do.
Yeah. Kelsa's about to rank
Kelsa
up.
Kelsa could break it too. But again, yeah. I think I have four most different appearances.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. And we got a lot of scholars coming back on this podcast that have been here before, and some new folks too, including Lindsay Chervinsky, who's going to be on in a few weeks. Joanne Freeman's going to be making her first appearance finally on this pod. For those of you listening, know that Joanne is also partially responsible for this mayhem, this HATM. So, yeah, I'm excited. But I was really excited. I didn't know we were going to get a Franklin series TV show until Liz Kobart, who is the creator of the Ben Franklin's World podcast, says, "Hey, you know those shows coming out?" And I was like, "Absolutely not." So I was really excited about this series, about the show. And then I saw it stars Michael Douglas. And I was like, oh, how is that going to work? So I thought what we're going to do here early on, let's talk about our opening thoughts about why we need a Franklin series, why Douglas, our thoughts on the casting, and then we'll break down. So if you have not seen the series yet, we'll let you know when we're going to start spoiling American history. It's hidden in all those books you may or may not have been reading. So we're going to kind of jump in there. So let's start here. Why, Kelsa, why do we need a Franklin series of all the people that we could do an early American series on? Why Franklin and why now?
Well, a couple of reasons. Craig will challenge me in this, I'm pretty sure, because this always comes up when we see each other. But Franklin is the most important figure for winning the American Revolution, because you don't win the war without French bullets. And the only reason Washington wins the war is because of French bullets. And me and him have argued about this constantly. And the other thing that's come up is I really love the fact that this is focusing specifically on Franklin's time in France, because a lot of people assume that his greatest contribution to the United States is electricity and everything. I'm like, no, his electricity inventions are important to the success of the British Empire. The most important thing he ever does as an American is what he does in France in securing American independence. And that is why I love the fact that it's so focused on this, because it's the other side of what we hear about all the time. It's not the violence that's happening in North America. It's all the behind the scenes seedy shit that's happening to be enabling this all to happen in the first place. And that's why it's really important. And also it helps that, you know, the new centennial is coming up for the war. Franklin also is really emblematic of a lot of things that are going on this time, like whether we like it or not with political things. Remember when President Trump left the White House and the picture of Andrew Jackson got moved and Franklin's portrait got moved in? There's a lot of symbolism going on, weirdly overlapping in the last couple of years at Franklin as well. So I think that's why Franklin now is important and why we need this series.
So I agree with a lot of what Kelsa said. I'm gonna correct some of it, but this is a matter of interpretation. She's absolutely right on the idea that Franklin. Yeah, I know. Oh, you know,
I like Jason. I'm not gonna come back. My light work. This is nice.
I'm not coming back on this show. No, it's
is that a promise?
Kelsa's basically, I agree with her. So before we go any further, I'm just going to say, before Jason starts accusing me of things.
Craig and me are friends, guys. Don't come for him in the comments. Yeah. Don't come for him in the comments. I give
Kelsa,
him enough.
If you want my opinion, Kelsa is a rising star. She will be Benjamin Franklin scholarship. Give her 10 years. Probably 5, but let's give her some space. So she is going to be the field. So when I challenge her, I am challenging someone who is literally an expert. She is the field.
Craig,
yeah, you got Stacey Schiff, you got Isaacson. They're around. They're old news. What have they had? Do they didn't even get a Netflix series?
A series is based on her book.
It was Netflix. Well,
to be fair, Craig is also like one of my biggest supporters in like everything that I do. So I appreciate that, Craig.
Thank you. I'm gonna have to knock her nonsense here.
Again, you can try.
So I think she's absolutely right, and this is something I just wrote about recently. The idea that if you ask people, and I literally did this, I started a poll on Twitter. What is Benjamin Franklin famous for? And it's always electricity, lightning, key, kite, electrocuted a turkey, you know, whatever. It's something to do with that. But Kelsa's right. His most impressive, his most important contribution is what he does in France. Mm-hmm. The Treaty of Alliance in 1778 that brings the French into the war. And then an offshoot of that would be the 1783 Treaty of Paris that brings peace, final recognition of the United States. I view those two as connected. You don't get the peace without the alliance. So absolutely right. If we're talking about most important founders, Franklin is no lower than number two. Obviously, Washington is far superior to him in every way possible, except for in scientific ability. I'm knocking this a bit.
However, let it be known that Franklin purposely allows Washington to take the throne from him, because he's perfectly happy to set back from the limelight after doing his duty in France. I would just like to have that point out to Craig, because I think he seems to have forgotten that about Franklin.
Well, Franklin also gets accused of being a little too French when he comes back home. But anyway.
There's no little.
But anyway, the idea is,
we'll get into that.
Is Franklin absolutely most famous man in the world during his lifetime. He influences so many things. He's a man of so many faces, so many different accomplishments. And the fact that this one focuses solely on Paris, which is probably his most important contribution, I think is huge here. We're going into all the 250 anniversaries. So whatever, you're going to have a 250th anniversary of, you know, Ben Franklin wakes up and looks west. So it's all fitting here. I'd like to think we're going to get more of this type of thing. But who knows? I've been wrong before on the future of the American Revolution on screen.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk a little bit about casting here, because looking at this cast here, it is largely Michael Douglas, and I think generally a bunch of unknowns. And for me, looking at this, I want to get your thoughts on the casting of Douglas as Franklin. For me, when I can't escape Tom Wilkinson through three episodes here. Whenever I'm looking at Douglas, I'm constantly thinking about how Tom Wilkinson have done this role. I largely named my second child Benjamin after Benjamin Franklin, largely after seeing Wilkinson as Franklin in the John Adams miniseries, because I was like, I loved the idea of Wilkinson's Franklin maybe more than anything else, right? What are our thoughts on the casting of Douglas? Is he too well known of a guy to be Franklin? Do you buy in? What are your thoughts, Kelsa?
Okay, so I have opinions. So here's the thing. I grew up with a lot of Douglas movie and stuff. Like I watched Romancing the Stone, some of his other like rom-commy movies, kind of sort of more of his like dramatic roles and stuff. So like I'm familiar enough with his body of work, and he's a great actor and everything like that. I forgot that he did a bunch of like history related things until I read Craig's recent op-ed on the series. I kind of forgot about all that other stuff. I guess I just didn't watch it as a kid. But when I first learned that Douglas is going to be Franklin, I kind of went, what the fuck? Like I'll be honest with you, because it's like, it's Douglas. He has such a different type of voice and style of acting. I wasn't sure how it was going to play out. And in my head, the perfect Franklin is Tom Wilkinson. Like, he's Franklin. If I could hang out with Franklin, I think he would look like him. The problem is not a problem, but it's like a surprisingly nice turn of events, even though he doesn't look like Franklin. Like lack of prosthetics and stuff like that. He also gives a lot more like 55-year-old Franklin, which that's a whole different genre of Franklin, in my opinion. If you like, you follow him through his years, he's like, he's not 70-year-old Franklin. He's more like 55-year-old Franklin in some energy and attitude. But the combination of like the fart jokes that show up like the first 13 minutes of the show in episode one, and like the seriousness of how he's delivering these lines and everything. I actually really like his portrayal and energy of Franklin with the seriousness and the little bit of levity. It plays more into the drama and stuff that like Douglas is more known for. And also like, it makes sense. Like you're not going to have the all jovial Franklin that we're used to seeing from the Adams miniseries. So I actually really like his portrayal with the energy he's bringing to it. Over time, I got so enthralled. I'm like, I kind of forgot for a second, like Franklin doesn't look like that, but he does look too much like Michael Douglas. But he does a good job of it. I think overall he's genuinely surprised me as being a good Franklin, which I'm very excited about, because otherwise it would have all gone to shit if you don't have the main man like being casted really well. So I think he surprised me being a very good Franklin.
Yeah, I think he's generally very good. And again, I was not sure as well what to think about this. And I think he delivers. He's convincing. Mm-hmm. Again, Kelsa hit on some of the points that, and it sounds so Hollywood. So if you look at some of the promotion stills for the series, he looks like Franklin. And like, wow, they really got him to look like Franklin. And then when you watch first few minutes of the show, you're like, wait a minute, that's Michael Douglas in a wig.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing was, and I'm sure the director had some say in this too, the costumers, but Douglas basically says he didn't want to wear any prosthetics or any of this makeup or any, because he said, oh, well, it hinders me. It's not, I don't feel free. So I'm questioning, is this Could this be a vanity thing? Does he want to make sure everyone knows it's Michael Douglas? The one thing I could say is Franklin Douglas as Franklin has a lot more hair than Franklin as Franklin.
He's also in pretty good of shape.
Yeah, I think so.
That age. And,
so this is it's much more, you know, Michael, you know, this is a handsomer Ben Franklin than we would have seen, which makes, I think, when we start getting into a lot of the, oh, he's like, you know, the sex symbol of Paris. The Ben Franklin.
That helps, considering Michael Douglas was like a dog back in the day as far as like every woman's like heartthrob kind of guy. Right. So like, I think Craig's kind of onto something there.
Michael Douglas is still a handsome guy. He's 79. He's still a handsome man. I think that changes the dynamic a little bit in that you can, it's almost like understandable that he is, you know, he's more attractive, you know, Michael Douglas than the real Franklin, who I'm reminded of. There's a line in Amadeus when you have like the female lead and she's playing in front of Salieri and, she's asking about Mozart, and Salieri says, oh, I think you'd be disappointed. She said, she goes, Maestro, only talent interests a woman of taste. Mm-hmm. So I think it's differing from that sort of older sense that Franklin's getting all this attention because of who he is rather than what he looks like. But overall,
I agree with that. I agree with that, actually, because that's one of the things that so many women like found so attractive about him was his intelligence and how he would engage in those intelligent conversations with him. So I do agree with Craig on that.
So I was fortunate enough to interview the director, Tim Van Patten, who also did Masters of the Air. He's also the EP on Shogun. I assume he doesn't sleep.
It's pretty,
and I
pretty
asked
good.
Him specifically
that's a,
this.
It's pretty like, good
why
punch.
Did you cast?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I asked him, why did you cast Michael Douglas? Because that was one of my big questions. And he said, the two of them have been circling separately together. So I think they, you know, the series was looking for a director at the same time they were looking to have, you know, a bigger name actor attached to it. But I asked him about that. And I said, well, why? And his response was, he said that Douglas and Franklin have the same spirit. And what he meant by that, I guess the same he referred to as like the glint in the eye, that sort of, you know,
I can see
I guess
that.
Like bad boy, you know, mischievous sort of element. And maybe they do. Again, you know, a lot of this is, you know, well, he doesn't get Franklin's voice right. How do I know? You know,
well, in my opinion, the most inaccurate thing in my brain personally is Michael Douglas's voice, but like
that sounds like Michael Douglas.
It's Michael Douglas. Like that's a kind of a signature Douglas thing, but
diplomacy for lack of a better word is good. but yeah, I think overall he does a really good job. The rest of the cast, the one person I'd really call out, I thought Lafayette absolutely nails it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's probably my favorite performance so far.
But yeah, I think the series lives or dies with Michael Douglas, and he does a good job. Can you suspend disbelief that, you know, this is what Franklin looked like? I think he's too big for that in a way that Wilkinson maybe wasn't. So I think he's got that
not to American audiences
against him, but at the same time, you don't get a big name. Yeah. But for the same time, you don't get a big name.
Mm-hmm.
Does it fly? So I'll live with it.
Yeah. As far as casting goes too, one of my favorites personally is, by, Ludivine Assegnier. I think that's how you pronounce her name, but the woman who plays Madame Brion, I think she fucking nails it. I was so pleased with her casting and her character portrayal so far. Without spoiling, I do have some hiccups, but that's writer's fault, not hers. I do think she played Brilliant like fantastically overall. I don't know who could have played her better, in my opinion, so far.
Well, she does, you know, get her chops in that historically accurate film known as Ridley Scott's Napoleon. So that explains it.
Yeah, there's a.
I might actually watch it if she's in there.
Yeah, she
no.
Go ahead.
No, do not watch Napoleon ever. I did don't, that don't so America it. Doesn't have to. No. As we head towards getting into this series itself, you know, one of the things I found, I'm finding that I really like, and this is also kind of goes along with Shogun, is that, you know, we don't get French spoken in English with just a French accent. You know, we're getting the language itself. I think that it really plays into showing the really this foreign world that Franklin is in. I really enjoy that. You know, and the other thing I want to kind of talk about here just quickly is in a lot of ways, say, going back and forth between, say, Douglas's Franklin and Wilkinson's Franklin, this is really a different man in time. And I think that we kind of get into that towards episode three, really, where we start to see that this is not the Franklin who really kind of knows it all, who is actually trying to figure things out. And I think one of the things the series is doing well thus far is showing that, hey, Franklin's got to work here. This is not, you know, when we see him and John Adams.
Yes.
It is Franklin has got this stuff figured out. He knows exactly what levers to pull, what buttons to press, when to talk and when not to. Here in France, it's a whole new ballgame, and he's trying to figure this out. So it is really almost like seeing that this last fighter kind of come back out for like one last round here to like fight through it. And he's having to work, at least, you know, from what we've seen in the first three.
I fully agree with you on that. Fully agree with you on that. Like, so a selfish plug. That's part of my research, why I'm so interested in the first year that Franklin's there for most of 1777, before France publicly recognizes the United States in February of 1778. The thing that I find the most interesting and one of my research points is why Brouillon is important for him, is what the series is doing really well is that Franklin has to get there. He doesn't have the right connections. He has to figure out society and stuff. He has to figure out how to get arms secretly done because the French government can't formally recognize him yet. Beaumarchais is another like fantastic acting job. I'm mm-hmm. thrilled with how Beaumarchais was played. Everything I read about him, it's nail on the head. Fantastic acting. I love his character. He's growing in my heart so much for that. But the other thing that's really important is like Franklin doesn't have it all figured out. He's trying to figure it out as he goes, and to play to Stacy Sheaf's book, it is really a great improvisation in what he's trying to do there on the ground. So you're completely right, because by the time Adams get there, a lot of the barriers that were in place for Franklin are no longer there. France recognizes the United States. Vergennes is no longer having to go around and hide things from Lord Stormont, the British ambassador to France, because again, this whole concept, and Craig knows more about this than me, but this honor situation, like that's the king's representative from another monarchy, someone you're supposed to not be frustrating or encouraging for war and things like this. Like these are genuine obstacles for Franklin. And I love how messy they show it in this period, because it genuinely is. It's not, Franklin doesn't just show up and his personality and figure works. Like they're purposely trying to institute this propaganda machine about him and putting his face on things at this time. And I love how messy it is in the first couple of episodes. It's great.
All right. Do we want to start kind of jumping into now and kind of set the stage for what we're seeing when we jump into the series? So if you're listening in, we've kind of set the stage. We'll give you some basic ideas about who we're talking about and why. Pause now if you haven't seen the series or you don't want to have it spoiled for you. And if not, we're going to keep rocking. And if you want to listen to this and then go back and watch it, maybe it'll inform what you're trying to think about anyways as you're watching through. Maybe it'll color some of your ideas about who people are and what they're doing. So that said, let's jump into what we've seen. We're going to talk through 1 through 3 just writ large. We don't need to separate the three. This series opens up. It's December 1776. Craig, where are we in terms of American-French relationships? Things do not look good for the good guys.
Well, American-French relationships, bottom line, there really isn't one. The big question here, and you know, the Declaration of Independence changed this somewhat. For the French don't like the British. The French basically, they have their strategy post-French Indian War, which ends in 1763, is revenge. They want to get revenge on the British. They'd like to reacquire lands they lost in Canada and in North America, what have you. But by and large, it is get revenge on the British. Mm-hmm. they're happy to support anything that hurts the British. The problem is, before the Declaration of Independence, is this some colonial squabble? Will the French get involved and then peace will be made and then America remains, you know, colonies under Britain? They don't want to risk that. By December 1776, Americans have issued the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence, in addition to all men are created equal, et cetera, is very much a document written for the international audience to mm-hmm. show, look, world, America is its own country, which means we can open up alliances and other diplomatic ventures, which basically it is a sign that says, world, we're open for business. We need allies. And mm-hmm. most of all, we need a friend that has a navy. We'll take money and guns and troops from whoever, but you need a pretty good navy, so which really limits their options. It's basically France and or Spain are really who they're trying to court to combat sort of the British. But December 1776, things are about as bad as they can be. They're probably the lowest point of the war. There's a few other points you could argue. Well, it was darker here at Valley Forge. Maybe it was. But if you're asking me, I'm saying it's December 1776. Why? Well, after all that initial hoopla and success of Lexington conquered and, you know, forcing the British out of Boston, it's sort of all that enthusiasm is waning. When people sign up, they signed up for a short war. And this is a common theme, the idea that, well, this war will be over by Christmas. Every war in history was supposed to be over by Christmas. They seldom are. And by December, Americans have lost New York. Well, Washington, the Continental Army, are on the run in New Jersey, literally hiding, running from the feared general that is Tom Wilkinson, better known as Lord Charles Cornwallis. Their enlistments are up. So the Continental Army, without a British bullet or a British or Hessian bayonet, could literally disintegrate in a few weeks. They only signed up for a little bit of time. They're underfed. They're undersupplied. They've just lost this devastating victory. It's going to basically establish a British headquarters in North America for the rest of the war. What are they going to do? Before this, you've had Silas Deane sent as a sort of secret emissary or secret ambassador, secret envoy, whatever you want to call him. He's been in France trying to recruit men. And he doesn't have the pull of someone like a Franklin. And I think this very much goes into, why do you send someone like Franklin? Well, because everyone knows who he is. Deane, though, does get one victory, and that is he's responsible for recommending a young nobleman, the Marquis de Lafayette, to get a general's commission. And so that really very much goes to Deane, although Franklin gives credit to Franklin for stuff he even doesn't do, which is normal. I mean, he gets credit for being president. So this is about as bad can get. Obviously, when Franklin lands, he doesn't know that Washington's going to pull off, you know, his Washington's crossing. That's going to, you know, keep the war going, reinvigorate the Americans. He doesn't know that. That hasn't happened yet. This is the moment when Thomas Paine, best known for Common Sense, everyone remembers that from your AP U.S. history. I said AP U.S. history, Jason.
Don't take AP history. Don't. I hate AP history. Don't. College. So, if you're listening, if you're College Board, go to hell. All right, keep going.
But Thomas Paine is embedded with Washington's army. He thinks he's like the original sort of war, you know, ye olde war reporter, and he writes, "This is American crisis. This is the time that try men's souls. This is as dark and as bleak as it can come." And that's why I really love how the series opens. Like, the intro scenes are like dark, like mm-hmm. pitch black. You can't even see anything. And I think it's very much playing on that. I think it's a brilliant artistic choice, saying, look, these are the dark days of the war. And then Franklin lands, you get this little hint of light, and it's like, well, what do you want? You know, Dr. Franklin, I'm hungry.
you know, it's so sort of human at the same time. Like, we have to take care of ourselves, our physical needs, while we have this whole sort of spiritual, moral revolution going on.
Mm-hmm. Kelsa, like, how fast is information traveling back and forth between the ocean? Like, we see this throughout the series, that information is flowing. Oh, did you hear? Oh, this guy is dead. Oh, this guy is dead. Oh, we lost a battle. We lost a colony. How fast is information going back and forth to crisscross, to feed information back and forth to France?
If it's going off of normal straight paths, it's going to take roughly 6 weeks. But because they're trying to use the smugglers' networks to get information around, and so ships are not taken, it can take anywhere for a couple months, because they're having to go like all these different roundabout ways to making sure like they are not captured on board ships, making sure letters aren't acquired from engagements on the water. So normally, like, the best time frame is going to be 6 weeks straight across, taking like the warm currents and everything. But because they're having to do everything secretly, and even just letters being smuggled back and forth between North America and Franklin and France, and even contacts in England, it's taking much longer. It's going to take closer to 3 or 4 months sometimes. And a lot of the times they're intercepted. A lot of the conversations that Franklin takes place between the and this happens with Dean, especially between the Continental Congress and the Secret Committee of Correspondence that Franklin's a part of, that sent Dean in the first place, like Craig said, that's taking months to get across. And a lot of them just go missing. And like, they'll write, like, we contacted you about this, still haven't heard from you. And then on the other side, they're saying, been here for several months, haven't heard from you. And it's a whole situation. Basically, communication is shit at best, none at worst. Is the simple solution there. And that's one of the reasons why, again, like, this improvisational thing that Franklin is doing, he's following his orders for being there, but he has a lot of leeway on how he has to go about and doing that. In one of the episodes, he makes a comment about saying about to Bancroft with, because this is a spoilery part, I can get into that now, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Okay. So one of the scenes, comment to Bancroft saying, like, I told Charmant that we'll be able to pay everything back if they fail. And Bancroft's like, can the United States do that? And he goes, they'll have to now. Like, it's he's having to fly on the go with a lot of taking there, because of that's the situation that he's having to deal with. But communication is, again, it's bad at best and none at worst. It's difficult.
Yeah, but this leads to some really interesting what if. So, and this speaks to Britannia rules the waves, right? Mm-hmm. The British Navy has a tremendous advantage. If France is openly, think about this now, France is openly in a war, their ships can be targeted, right? Mm-hmm. This is sort of benefit of their status is questionable, right? It depends which way you're crossing the Atlantic. One way is faster than the other way. Here's a big what if, and this is something that was discussed. Let's say the British St. Franklin ship, before he lands in France, what does that do?
Well, they almost did. Remember, yeah, the reprisal, they keep this out of the show, but the reprisal that Franklin's on, mm-hmm, is actually in a sea battle, and they capture a British vessel, and they have prizes when they get into the French port to sell that they were going to do when Dean was there, but that port's taken out, which I again agree with Craig. It's probably an artistic style showing like this dark time of the war. So, on the other hand, Franklin's a pirate already because he's literally on a ship that engaged in piracy. But they've already, like, that is a real what if. Franklin could have died had the ship been sunk on the way over there with his two grandsons. That was a very big possibility.
And then you get John Adams yelling at, you know, Louis the 16th in English.
Don't even get me started on John Adams. We'll get to that.
We're going to see him.
I think that's
he's coming.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Eddie Marchand. So, it's interesting you say this, and I'll put this in your head too, right? We talk about, like, what would have happened if this had happened to Franklin as far as getting sunk or getting killed on his way to France, right? But the reality is that other Benjamin Franklins have died in battle, of disease. People who would have changed the world have had their lives cut short before their moment in time as well. Like, it has to happen, right? So what we're doing is sitting in this one line of contingency where those contingent things never happened. But it does reinforce the fact that there are other great people who have been struck down, you know, in their time. Mm-hmm. And Kelsa, I want to ask you this because one interesting thing,
and then Kelsa could speak to this.
the fact that communications are so bad in some ways benefits Franklin.
Absolutely.
So imagine, again, Franklin is, he is, you know, this genius. He is this guy that's able to think on his feet. He is this guy that could play all these different parts. He is not by his nature. And we've seen this since he's a young man running away. He's not necessarily a rule follower. So the fact that he is not getting, he's got this general sort of order, you know, get an alliance with France. Okay, I can do that. Doesn't tell him how to do that. If he was getting more specific guidance or more specific orders, does that put him in a spot where he has to go against Congress? And I think he really benefits from this. It's like the right guy at the right time with the right environment.
Yep.
And if he's got some, you know, handcuffs on him, no, you must do this, you must do this, you must engage in a certain way. Would he be able to do that? We've seen throughout his life that generally he is someone who pushes back against the more established norms.
Yeah, I fully agree with that, actually. That exact question actually came up the Friday night. I had a couple of friends over and had my wine and watching and paused. They had questions the whole time while watching. And that was the same question I got. They're like, so is Franklin the United States in France right now? I'm like, kind of. Like, he's not able to get in touch with everybody over there. And he's having to make a lot of on-the-ground decisions on behalf of Congress as a member of Congress and then as a member of the Secret Committee of Correspondence. And a lot of people kind of forget that not only does he have a lot of like leeway in doing these things, but he also has a lot of power in how he's able to decide these things. There's a lot of trust in the decision making that he's going to be able to have on the ground. And a lot of other people, I would argue, no matter who they are, I don't think they would have as much leeway had someone else been sent to France that was not Franklin. I don't think there would have been enough trust in somebody of his experience to go there. Because it is true, like, he's not a diplomat. Like, a lot of people like go kind of back and forth with him being a diplomat and stuff. There's a joke about that from, I want to say it's a character who plays Turgot, actually, between Virgin and him, who I believe is talking to Maripaw in the first or second episode. Like, these unskilled, they don't know the world and everything. And that is true. Like, Franklin knows a lot of what he knows in France because of, like, people who he was in contact through the Royal Society in London. And also for getting his books translated into French and other languages. Those are his only real contacts in France at the time. But the other side of that, he was a colonial agent for 15 years in England. So he got to deal with the personal politicking still. While he's not doing diplomacy in the traditional sense, he is the negotiating things on behalf of his colony in England and still amongst members of parliament. So it's a half-assed version of experience, but he understands this political game he's going to have to play. And from the beginning understands, like, we need France's help. We have to do everything we can to get France's help. And he has a lot of that, again, that Craig is completely right. That lack of communication in a lot of ways benefits him from being able to get things. I think I would argue, though, because they sent Franklin with such a specific job and he has so much experience and authority and respect from the other delegates in the Second Continental Congress, I would argue that even if they had more clear lines of communication, I still think they'd be like, do what you need to get done, because they sent him with that kind of instruction in the first place. I think they understood, we just need the alliance. That's all we can even hope to get at this point. So.
But you have to think about, who do the Americans, what are their options? He's literally the best they've got.
Yeah. John
he actually
Adams.
Has some experience. He's
no, well, stop.
John, so the thing
I have
is,
my own opinion on that. I don't want people to come for me in the comments.
He's been to Paris. He's been abroad. He's actually been, if we're going back, he's been out of the country like the past 20 years. Something like that, right?
Yeah, he was in England for 15 years. For two of those years, at one point, he took two different technical like tours of Europe for his health, yes, because of the London weather at one point.
So he's been gone for a while. And so he's got, and then the idea is he's got the name. His diplomacy is very much reputation and fame and name trading, that he gets some instant buy-in and some instant credit because of who he is. Yeah. And I'm reminded of, and this is we're going to bring back to another HATM favorite, Arnold Schwarzenegger. So Arnold Schwarzenegger, well, how am I going to make this connection? You're going to love it. So Schwarzenegger at one point was discussed as being ambassador to Russia, because the idea was that Schwarzenegger could out-macho Putin, or more so that Putin couldn't out-macho Schwarzenegger. So all his sort of strongman
bit, I can see that. That's actually
wouldn't work on Arnold. Arnold would throw out his one-liner, and it wouldn't work. So the idea that Schwarzenegger, again, one of the most famous men in the world, internationally recognized, shows up in Russia, but he's there as a symbol of the United States, and he gets some instantaneous heft, even from the people of sort of like Russia. And you saw this with his message to the Russian people. That's what we're talking about with Franklin. He gets that instant buy-in, even over perhaps some, you know, officials in France, some figures in France. So Louis XVI becomes infuriated with Franklin, so much so that he commissions chamber pots with Franklin's face in them. And I think it's that same sort of mindset that if it wasn't Franklin, it may not work. And like, I know we're talking about, you know, contingency and all that, but if not Franklin, then who?
Yeah.
I think is a big question.
Craig, I think you bring up a great idea, which is what if we had actually cast Arnold Schwarzenegger as Franklin in this series? That's...
Oh, Lord. You know, don't give him ideas, Jason.
It's his Canadian
margin. I'm still waiting. I am still waiting for Arnold to go from he was Von Steuben in Liberty Kids. We have to do the big budget Washington document, a big budget Washington movie where you just hear the voice off screen and then he walks on like.
So yeah, but it's like dudes. No, we've taken Saratoga. So you know these are I can just riff all day. It's my podcast. One of the things that. One of the things I dig about this this show is really setting up well is the tension of urgency on the part of the Americans whose great gamble is about to fail, and the lack of urgency on the part of the French who are like, this is the game you got to play. And, you know, there's a real tension going, we need this. This has to happen right now. And the French are utterly like, yeah, not really our problem. Like, we're happy just to watch you fight. Like, what's in it for us if we don't just watch you guys just tear each other to pieces to begin with? It's okay for us to watch you have a civil war.
Yeah.
Right? What are your thoughts on that? Like, at what point in time? I mean, we obviously see there are some early backers on the part of the French towards the American colonists. What becomes this tipping point when people start to see, hey, wait a second, this would be a real way to screw over these English guys who, you know, cost us an empire in North America? Is it Saratoga itself?
I mean, it's interesting because everyone. So let's talk about this, and this gets really interesting. But bottom line, this is diplomacy 101. This is basic. This is nations who have national interests that conflict with citizens that have or subjects that have personal interests or financial interests. There's lots going on here, and sometimes people have multiple reasons. Sometimes those multiple reasons conflict. Sometimes they align. So let's look at this big picture. Why do nations engage in diplomacy? To get something they want. Bottom line, right? Mm-hmm. So what do the Americans want? They want this alliance with France. Why? Because they have a great love of France? No, actually, if you're thinking historically, Americans are terrified of France. France is big and scary. France loomed up in Canada or on the frontier waiting to appear in a local Protestant village near you and bring the Pope. Mm-hmm. Again, and I'm joking, but that's literally what people believe, that, you know, one night, you know, think of like things like the Quebec Act in 1774. One day you're going to wake up and then there's going to be some Jesuit, like, you know, at your, you know, dining room table.
Well, that is true though, because one of the Intolerable Act situations was to allow Catholic toleration after the Port of Boston was closed, and it pissed off the Puritans there. So, like, you know, I fully agree with Craig on that.
So it's France is not, there is a fear of France, and you could even see this in some of, like, you know, early founding discussions. So, like, for instance, Benedict Arnold, we know, a very reputable individual, but he was once, and he was very much afraid of this sort of French alliance. I mean, the people we've been fighting for generations, and now we have to make friends with them. Fear that, you know, they're gonna stab us, and they're gonna, you know, double deal us, grab land. So this isn't
the most, this isn't some nice, easy, amicable relationship. So that's part one. Mm-hmm. America, what do they want? They want America to survive. This is a put it in like modern IR, like international relations theory. This is survival level interest for the Americans. Mm-hmm. It is not that for the French. Is it important? Is it peripheral? That's a whole other thing. The one thing that the Americans have going for them is the British and the French basically fight every generation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this post 1945 or 20th century to 21st century France and Britain not fighting, that is the anomaly. They usually fight, you know, every generation. So the idea was, yes, the last war ended in 1763. All right, we're about at, you know, 13 years later. We're due for another one. If not now, then pretty soon. The sense is from both sides that there's going to be another war. What's it going to be over? I don't know. Where's it going to be? I don't know. Who are we going to fight? Britain, France. They know, you know, it's unlike today, you know, sort of like, well, where the next war in the world is going to look like? I don't know. But then, no, Britain and France are going to fight. It's just a question of where, when, why.
Yeah. To piggyback off of that, that was what's so interesting that I really like geeked out about watching Virgin and her going at it, like debating with the character who I'm assuming is supposed to represent Maurepas or Louis the 16th. I wasn't sure really in the scene because Maurepas is like super old at the time. So I'm assuming that young man working on things is supposed to be Louis the 16th.
Yeah, that's Louis.
It's supposed to be Louis. Okay. So one of the things that's really fascinating about is if you get into the weeds, a lot of it is revenge and everything like that. But Virgin is such a brilliant, like diplomatic mind and figure. Really quick biography of him. He has a lot of experience abroad, especially at the court of Vienna as an ambassador of France. And he is there where the Empress of Austria is trying to negotiate a like kind of an entangled alliance between George III and Catherine the Great of Russia at one point. Virgin, this is back like 10 or 15 years prior to the war situation, but he's like watching all these negotiations and other entangled alliances kind of forming while he's there. And that threatens them because he knows Russia wants to go after the Turks, the Ottoman Empire, who is a traditionally longstanding ally of France at the time, going back to like the 1500s. And so the long con for Virgin is we have to weaken Britain now and support the Americans, even secretly throughout the whole war, because we need them to be as weak as possible when we go to war with them again, when we have to defend the Ottoman Empire from Russia, who is now entangled with England. It's this giant, convoluted thing. And also, besides revenge, it's to kind of go back to the old status quo and rebalance this situation with the balance of power, because now England is the most geographically dominant country, nation, empire in the world. Like, this is where you get the sun never sets on the British Empire phrasing after they take North America and everything from France. So it's revenge, it's reestablishing, like, everything going back to the status quo and somewhat to weaken Britain. And also, we got to protect our allies, the Ottoman Empire, down the road, because they also have, like, one of the more dominant accesses to the spice trade through them as well, because that's still going on at this time. So it's incredibly complicated. And I like how they kind of simplify it down to this revenge situation, because it's easy to keep track of. But on the other side of this, this is, like Craig said, it's been building and building up, but weirdly enough, the conflict of them coming here between England and France is like, it's a bump for the bigger war that will become later in Virgin's mind, which is why he's so enthusiastic about trying to make sure the Americans do get French resources. He's like, no, we need them to win and hurt England as much as possible, so when we go to war later, we have a better advantage. It's very, very smart on his part.
So think of it in modern day, like a proxy war using. Yeah.
There are a couple main storylines here on this show. One, of course, the dominant one is Franklin trying to essentially save the American dream by getting French support. The other, and we haven't talked about this character and this person in history yet, is this relationship between Franklin and his grandson, Temple. So I think a lot of people, I don't know that a lot of people are familiar with this unique relationship, why they hint at it throughout the first episode before it's spelling it explicitly, why Franklin's son and Temple's father is not in the picture. early on. I like how they kind of set that, kind of tease that out a bit. But can we talk a little bit about who Franklin's grandson is and the relationship between the two of them and why, say, Franklin has custody of this child? And your thoughts also on the portrayal of
his father. So his father was William Franklin, was the royal governor of New Jersey. And there's a line in the play 1776, as that title would suggest, they are not in touch at present. The idea that William Franklin, William Temple Franklin's father, shows Benjamin Franklin's real attempts to raise himself within the British Empire. You know, the youngest son of the youngest son for five generations back, William Franklin, you know, illegitimate born, becomes a royal governor. That is tremendous, you know, social ladder climbing. Mm-hmm. Franklin sees himself and his family really advancing in the British Empire. The revolution and the rumblings earlier really are going to derail him in many ways. Mm-hmm. And so why is William Temple there? Well, his father's in prison. He's probably been moved to Connecticut by this point.
I don't remember when he moved.
But so William Temple's there, well, for a couple of reasons. Well, to keep him away from the influence or the connection or association with his father, who is a loyalist. The other thing is, how did young men get educated, get prepared for a career? Well, you'd go to Europe, and most Americans can't do that. Actually, very few can. So this is a chance for Ben Franklin to cultivate his grandson, who is also illegitimate, mm-hmm. in a way that most Americans don't have the opportunity to. So, and Kelsa, you may want to talk. Kelsa loves all the dirt on the Franklin family, so I'll let her tell you how he gets the name Temple.
I thought about this the other day. I forgot how he gets the name Temple. I'm not going to lie to you, because I thought about that the other day when I was trying to go through all my notes. But
I set you up for it.
I know you did, but you strike out sometimes. It happens. Even Michael Jordan has a day off, Craig. So
can I jump in and throw it out there?
Basically, though, the situation with William Franklin is very, very interesting. Yes, he's the illegitimate son of Dr. Franklin and everything like that. He ends up getting raised by his stepmother, Deborah Franklin. Over time, he is the one that actually does hold the lightning brass key and everything during Franklin's experiment. He's the one who goes into the rain to do it. So they have a very, very close relationship growing up, very well connected. He goes with his father to England when he's a colonial agent for Pennsylvania and ends up being kind of like a senior advisor to other colonial agents while he's there. That's where he gets involved in all these other politicking. He makes friends in England, starts getting favors, gets more recognition, builds up in society and everything. And then on the side, he has an illegitimate child, which is William Temple Franklin. And one of the first rifts you have between Dr. Franklin and William Franklin, though, is because William refuses to marry the woman that Franklin wants him to marry. And at one point, I want to say Franklin actually doesn't attend the wedding when William Franklin does get married, if I'm remembering correctly, because there's a lot of details in Franklin's long life. But when everything happens and Franklin is slandered and assaulted verbally with the Privy Council in the cockpit, when he learns that William has decided to stay and support and be loyal to the King of England, loyal to Parliament and everything, he takes it as a genuine personal betrayal, as like not only has he done everything for his entire life for the betterment of the British Empire, it's like British Empire has turned his back on him and his son in a lot of ways. And he's crushed by it. The portrayal of Douglas's reaction to that when that conversation comes up with Regen in one of their first secret meetings is very palpable. And I would dare say pretty accurate for like the pain that he's experiencing. And the buildup between this fight with him and Temple is really, really interesting, because he's illegitimate, never got to know his father in a lot of respects because of everything going on. And now he's learning that his father is quote unquote a traitor, but his grandfather is also quote unquote a traitor. He's been uprooted from where he was growing up. Now he's in French society. He's having to learn all these things. And down the road, he'll get swept up in a lot of European-esque aspects that Craig's already talked about, which that's his own problematic thing for him down the road. But like, yeah, the relationship that Franklin has with like this breakup with him and his relationship with the Empire and the breakup and his relationship with his son is really, really powerful. And it overlaps a lot with like arguably like some not just trauma, but longstanding tension between him and Temple, especially since he's trying to now educate Temple for a trade, for experience, to get like to almost like kind of have a redo with Frank, with William, where he kind of went wrong in a lot of ways, which is really, really interesting because you can see that dynamic kind of being set up by the writers, which I find fascinating personally.
But what's interesting is this is something other families would have been dealing with as well. You know, the divided loyalties. It's mm-hmm. just with the Franklins, it's happening on a grander scale, right? Yeah. They are celebrity family. It's not just, you know, whoever down the street. So it's playing out on a stronger level. What's interesting, though, and maybe not, is that Franklin brings two grandsons to France, mm-hmm. but we only hear about William Temple because 7-year-old Benjamin Franklin Bache probably would have been more regulated by child labor laws. So easier to get rid of, I assume.
Yeah.
Craig, do you want to spell go ahead and tell us about the name?
Yeah. So again, this is all conjecture, but I believe it's said that the reason he got the name was William Temple was at, William Franklin was at one of the Inns of Court, which was Middle Temple. And that is where, I believe Temple's that during that time is when he was conceived.
I've heard of that, but I've never heard if that's confirmed or not. So
I don't think it's confirmed, but it's a good story.
I mean, it's a good story, yeah. But
I don't know if that's true.
I'm not as established as you, Craig. I can't just say that's possibly true nowadays.
I'm going to throw it out there. Why not?
Good Lord. It'd be like me naming a kid gas station bathroom or something. I don't even know. So, you know, I want to ask actually about this. You guys are talking. I want to talk actually about the portrayal of Franklin. We get the sense when we are watching, again, I keep referring back and forth to Adams, but we always got this sense for people coming into this that Franklin is a bit of a Lothario. We see that here a bit, that's growing here. Kelsa, how much is that myth and how much is that reality? We see a bit of a romance between of a 70-year-old man building in this series in the first three episodes. What's reality on Franklin's love life here? Like, is he a player?
Oh God, fucking yeah, he is. Here's the thing, because I've gotten asked like very, very weird questions about Franklin over the years. So I am sorry for the sensibilities of your listeners. I've gotten asked before, did Franklin like invent cunnilingus? Absolutely not. We know it's a lesbian. Only a woman would know how to do that. Let's be honest with ourselves. I've gotten asked like, what was he packing because of all the women he's associated with and sleeping with? And I'm like, the fact that I had to actually like, give an educated guess once was fascinating, but it happened to be a friend and we were drunk. So, you know, I entertained the thought. But it's much easier to say who Franklin did not sleep with because he is known so much for being a lecherous man. And that's one of those things that I have issues with. I understand why they have writing that they go in with Brilliant and his friendship with her. But Brilliant did not sleep with Franklin. And you can tell because of the letters. That's a whole thing with my research. But it's much easier to say who he did not sleep with versus saying who he did sleep with. Because it's like, this is those period in times, and you still have things like this, like kind of overlapping today. It's very dangerous for a woman's sexual honor and like her social capital to be alone in a room with a man who's not her father or her husband, you know? So like that, and again, by association, Franklin's a lecherous man. He's also a widower. He's not tied down to being subtle about chasing women. He's a widower. He can do what he wants at this point. All these French women are fascinated by him, being that he's, you know, quote unquote, the lightning tamer. And like people think he invents electricity and who is he to say to dissuade them otherwise, like he says in the first episode. He is literally a superstar to them. And because of how Franklin is so charming and everything, he also will talk to women and engage with them in these intellectual conversations and things. And I can see the appeal of being a young woman and an older, respectable, intelligent man, like, treat you like an equal in this, like, repartee of conversation. And they get wrapped up into this in a lot of ways. And that's one of the things I think they did really well on screen with his friendship with Brilliana in a lot of ways. It's like, they're doing this back and forth, and it's like there's this sexual tension thing going on, but she never has sex with him. I have a feeling based off the trailer that they're going to have it, that they do have sex, which, I mean, I don't blame them. It makes for good TV. But again, it's one of those things, like, of course it's going to be good TV and to show that, because that's the thing what we know about Franklin. Y'all know he has sex in France. So it's going to be easy to play up to that role in the series as well. But no, Franklin had a very good time. He had a good time as a young man in England before he married Deborah. Yes, he was married to Deborah the entire time in England. I would not be surprised if he and Mrs. Stevenson, his landlord lady, had some kind of relationship of some sort. At one point, they reviewed when they go out to society as, like, being a couple, quote unquote. And there's a whole situation there. But Franklin's also, again, like Craig said earlier on, he's being very French-like. It's the French nature not to necessarily have sex, because I still meet scholars here who are Americanists who are like, it's not so much as, like, frowned upon that men and women are having affairs and stuff. I'm like, not really. Yeah, the men are doing it just like the French men are doing it the same way as the British and English men and stuff like this. But, like, women are still women. They can flirt and everything. And actually, Brilliant says this in a letter to Franklin when he's trying to persuade her towards a more sexual relationship. She says, and I'm paraphrasing from the translation, but she basically says, you are a man, I am a woman. We may think the same, but we may not act the same. Propriety changes within every generation. She, like, literally says that. Like, she's very aware that her honor and reputation would be affected by being associated as having sex with Franklin. And also, again, she's a mother. Like, she's not a nobleman or a noblewoman or anything like that. Like, they're aristocrats and come from a good family, but they're not nobles or anything like this. She's still got daughters she's got to marry off. That would taint her in that association. That's why her calling her down the road, and this is a spoiler, when she's going to call him Papa, it's this a familial barrier has been put in place. So it kind of protects her from being able to be alone with him in the room. Because that happens in the show, right? Like, her husband comes in and makes the crack about, have you been kissing my wife? Which I have a whole separate opinion about how smarmy they make him. But we'll get to that later. But, like, yeah, Franklin is definitely having sex in France. Franklin is as much as the charming man that we see him in this show from Wilkinson as well in Adam series. Like, he is definitely that character and that kind of personality. But to say that he's got the energy for all that extra cardio is probably a stretch.
No, so what's interesting here, and this is, you know, he is the rock star. This is Beatlemania. This is Elvis. He is going to be mobbed by people sort of all classes. Mm-hmm. Is he being, you know, chased by the women of Paris because he's some, like, devilishly handsome man? Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. This is about who he is, right? This is about his status. It's also about how a connection to him can raise your own status.
Exactly.
So everyone wants to be around him. And this isn't necessarily a sexual thing. This is men and women. They can elevate themselves by their connection to him. Mm-hmm. That they can name drop him. Mm-hmm. That they can elevate themselves. So this is going on at the same time. So is he flirting? Yeah, this is a convent. This has been traditional sort of French court life. I think Kels is right. And I think it gets overplayed that he is, you know, is he this Lothario? Is he, you know, is he like Fabio? Is his, like, shirt constantly ripped open with his hair flowing in the breeze?
What a rough.
Are women lining up to sleep with him? Probably not. And I think the show, again, I don't want some spoiler alerts, but the show, I think, gets it in some ways right that there is only one sex, Benjamin Franklin, sexy in this whole show. And I think you would have really hurt the show had they had, like, some revolving door of, like, Franklin, like, you know, slipping out of windows in, you know, his 70s, like, avoiding husbands and stuff like that. The director said he wanted to go for the whispers rather than the easy, like, shock value of, you know, Franklin's sex symbol.
And accurate too, which is, I appreciate that direction.
Yeah. So again, this is something I've joked about, you know, before, but the idea, founding flirt is probably accurate. Founding daddy, not accurate.
God, don't ever say that again, Craig. I hate that.
No, but it's just think about the changes of how these words actually have evolved. Right. And when you start hearing, like, you know, dear papa to an American audience today in the 21st century.
Yeah. Well, you're not wrong. It's a little.
It's weird.
Yeah.
It does make sense, though. Well, that a person carrying a lot of Franklins could be a sugar daddy. So, you know, these are the things I'm thinking about as we watch the show.
Yeah.
I want to ask about this idea. Franklin can't do a lot. He's in France. He can't get into Paris. So what's he trying to do? He's trying to print. He's kind of going back to his strengths, right? And he starts trying to drum up. Can we talk a little bit about why this is frightening the French? Why he cannot have a printing press, you know, on him, and why, you know, we get to the end of episode 3. Where he's back in action again. And also, would Ben Franklin have a podcast? These are the questions I have to ask.
Well, of course, Ben Franklin would have a podcast, but it would he would basically – I could see him very much interviewing himself, where he'd play like different characters.
For those of you who've read the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like – and today we have Silence Do-Good. It would be like, hello, I'm Silence Do-Good. you know – I could see more of a Franklin variety show. And now the Key and a Kite singers, you know, something like that. So why?
I'm picturing this and I both love and hate it with every fiber of my being, Craig.
So the printing press, let's think about this. The printing press was information. It was words. This is an American revolution that is about liberty, that, among other things, right? We could go in the fine grain detail, but liberty, it's anti-monarchical. It's about removing a king.
Mm-hmm.
That is about as, if you are a monarch in Europe, that is about as terrifying a prospect as you can think of. And the French, France has an absolute monarchy. France has sort of invented the absolute monarchy. So if we're thinking about, you know, George III being labeled a tyrant, England, even under George III, is a lot freer than France.
Mm-hmm.
Franklin knows that, but very much playing on the ego, and that's something you're going to see the show. It's like, well, the Americans would not have to rebel had we had, you know, your most gracious majesty, rather than the tyrannical George III.
Mm-hmm.
So free, open press, something spreading the idea of liberty. Even if it's about another country, that stuff's contagious.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have that. You could get a revolution in France in, you know, another 10, 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
The king could get his head chopped off. You know, it's these are very real fears.
Yeah. I fully agree with that personally. One of the reasons why I really like that they focused on that too is it shows again, like, the messiness of the situation and how Franklin is having to drum up ways of keeping the French public engaged about what's going on in North America. Because again, the French government's publicly ignoring them besides all the things on the side. Because Franklin's aware, and like, we know this today, even it's much easier to get people to side and fight for a war if it's like a morally supported war, or like you're just at least enthusiastic about it. The French public are going to be more inclined to want to volunteer to go and fight, or want to go and fight once France recognizes them and stuff, or even be more vocal about wanting to support the Americans if they're seeing it in their faces every day. So this propaganda machine that Franklin's trying to drum up is really, really important, obviously. And while it's small scale, it's doing a lot of work. Because one of those is going to be read just like they do back in North America and British coffee houses and taverns. Like, one person's going to be reading these to a bunch of people in these spaces. So it's really, really important of having the Americans not only like know why he's there, And he's this, you know, American like superstar, but also like keeping in the back of their mind, like drumming up all these like glamorous and largely exaggerated successes of the Americans. Because who, what are they going to say otherwise? Of course, the English is saying they're winning. They're the ones fighting us. But look what we're doing. And it's very much a smart tactic on what Franklin has to do in starting to establish his own information network on the ground as well while he's in Paris.
But think about it today, like modern day, like the war in Ukraine against Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And think about the early days when this was, you know, the perception of Russia has invaded. This is a, you know, Zelensky was on social media. And now since then, has been literally doing the rounds to different countries. This is a war for liberty. This is a war for democracy. This is a war for freedom. Drumming up, literally having foreigners come and join the Ukrainian army. That's what Franklin's doing. That's what Silence Dean before him was doing. We actually need people to fight. We're going to give you this, our high ideals, our romanticized elements. We need you. We need you to fight for liberty. So it's in that same sort of sense that Franklin's operating. Obviously, the methods and the reach are different, but it's the same motivating. It's the same attempt at motivating.
Yeah.
I got one last question I want to ask before we kind of start circle back to our general thoughts about the series and where it's going and so forth. And maybe any tips that you've got with this, because Kelsey, I know you said you had kind of one thought on this. We got to talk about Bancroft, because by the end of the episode 3, we realized he is the traitor in the midst. Who is this guy, Bancroft?
Can you repeat that? It kind of.
I think he's asking about Bancroft.
Oh, Bancroft. Okay. Oh my God, what is there about Bancroft? Bancroft is such an interesting figure in a lot of ways, because of one, he knows Franklin from earlier on when he is in England, and so they already have a friendship and everything. And so the reason why he's a contact on the ground when Franklin gets there is really, really important. Also, because of his time in France, Bancroft knows people who he can possibly get Franklin to talk to, and in and out of these conversations of people who might have some play in the French court and stuff. And that's all really, really true. But Bancroft's role in being a spy is incredibly accurate. It's not until long after his death that I want to say people learn that he's actually been a spy the entire time. The only person who really try to accuse Bancroft when he is there is actually going to be Arthur Lee, but he's also, like Dean, not included in this narrative. And I don't really blame them. Lee is a messy, messy guy. And all the other infighting and stuff that would have happened between him, Dean, Bancroft, Franklin would have been really, really too messy, honestly, and detract from what the series is trying to do, which is focus on the French relationship. But Bancroft the entire time is feeding information back and forth. Franklin makes a crack later about, if people are spying on me, I have nothing to hide anyway. They know what I'm doing here, which I think is largely kind of like another American spin. Like, they found this out and that sucks, but like, I have nothing to hide kind of deal, just to kind of placate to those, the way he likes to spin the narrative and everything. But Bancroft's a really fascinating dude in a lot of ways. Complete traitor, obviously, to the Americans. But that's one of the things that's really interesting when you see him talking to Lord Stormont. And I love who plays Lord Stormont. I think the subtlety of his character being inserted is fantastic. But it's really poignant when you look at like what Bancroft is doing when he gets asked, "Do you consider yourself a Britishman or an American?" And Bancroft goes, "I wasn't aware that there was a difference." Like, he's being very smart about this because he's getting a lot of money. But there is a letter that I want to say George III writes to one of his members of his Privy Council, then circles back to eventually Lord Stormont, the British ambassador to France, where he's like, basically, the information Bancroft's giving us is not worth the money we're paying for it. So Bancroft's just an interesting character in a lot of ways. Definitely a traitor, definitely giving information. But according to some people, they don't think it's worth the money they're investing in the first place.
So one thing I want to bring up before we run out of time, and I think doesn't get enough airtime in the series, and that is Ben Franklin's fur hat.
Yes.
So again, the fur hat is famous. Again, if you look at any image of Franklin in France during that period, he's got on his fur hat. And I think we need to talk about the significance of that fur hat. And I think we have to talk about how come he is in actuality, Franklin's basically got this thing on morning, noon, and night. You know, it's a costume. It's meant to signify, you know, his Americanness, his frontier. Look at me. I'm a mountain man. Where's Philadelphia? I don't know. The mountain somewhere. it's meant to convey this, but at the same time, the series doesn't use it as much as he would have worn it. So I think we need to talk about what's the significance of the fur hat. Why does he have a tricorn hat on, probably in equal portions to the fur hat? What is the appeal of that fur hat? Why do we have, like, you know, Marie Antoinette, like, you know, hairstyles with, oh, I would put that fur hat on?
The simple answer is, as at the time, actually, Jason, this might play into your current position. You might be able to say a lot to this, but one of the things that's really fascinating at the time prior to the American Revolution is France has always had a fascination with North America, and specifically like the North American Indian, like the image of a Native American. And unfortunately, for good or worse, a lot of it is played into like the noble savage trope in a lot of ways, and like the concept of like this wild continent changing the men and stuff, like that's where we get the Côte d'Ivoire, the Frenchmen be changing and taking on the more like Native American like livelihood, them living with the tribe and everything when they're up in Canada and the fur trade and all these things. And when Franklin's coming over with this fur hat, it's very emblematic of like almost like an like early version of Crevecoeur, who is this American, this new man, in a lot of ways. Like Franklin is showing what happens when a British person is changed by North America and has all this like this influence showing. So that's what the fur hat's doing. It's placating to like people's fascinations, not just with him as inventor of the electricity, but also this quintessential like Americanist man. And so it's such a good tool of propaganda, and again, like just fascination. That's why he wears like the simpler garb. He's not wearing the very impressive, expensive clothing like Bancroft is wearing. He wore that in England when he's a colonial agent, but he's not wearing that in France. So even when he's not wearing the fur hat and stuff, the outfits he's wearing is the simple brown outfits and everything. He's making sure he's showing he's an American. That's why that quip that he makes with Bancroft, and Bancroft's just like, "What are you wearing?" He goes, "Like, who are you supposed to be? I'm an American." It's a very simple, but that's what the fur hat is doing. It's placating to all these things that French people associate with North America, and showing how this wild American man is like really like the epitome of like the Enlightenment. So it's a very interesting combination that you're seeing with that. But they do need to show it more. I fully agree with Greg. I'm sad that they don't.
But here's the interesting thing. It's also doing other things. Like if you think about like Sherman's always on about, you know, oh, I will be a great trading partner. It's Franklin showing off the wares. Hey, we've got fur. Mm-hmm. You know, this will be fun. This will make great, you know, accents for your haute couture.
The fur hats specifically, the hats that is a French fashion staple, is made from the American beaver. So it's like, you lost the fur trade in Canada, but like, help us out. We can get you back access to that fur trade.
And the other thing that I think is really sort of interesting about Franklin's, this is all pre-planned. Like he's writing letters about that, you know, I need this hat. It has to look this way. It has to fit, you know, low down on my forehead, maybe to cover up that he's balding. Again, I'm sure Franklin's got some vanity going on too. And he says, think about how this hat will look in a sea of powdered heads, mm-hmm. Right? So he's imagining French court culture of powdered wigs. You know, this is a time where you have women wearing, you know, the coiffure de l'independence. So like these big Marie Antoinette, you know, hair with like a ship in it. He's setting himself as something different. And in doing that, wearing his plain brown suit, you know, he's dressing the part of a Quaker. He's not a Quaker. Although I think the show makes it look a little more richer than it would have been. It didn't look like homespun to me, but, you know, costumer's got to show off, I suppose. But the idea is he's setting himself apart. So he is, in some ways, wearing the most avant-garde of all fashion. He's going minimalist. And that everyone is going to look to that. And it draws eyes to him that, you know, he's got the eyes anyway. But if you're really sort of paying attention to him. So I think that how he crafts his image is just as much important as how he actually like plays the role. Yeah. But I think it needed more. And again, with the, what they do see with the costumes, they try to mimic, Franklin's dress in a lot of his portraits.
Yeah.
May not be necessarily contemporary, but that's what they're going for. So you see like his blue and gold, you know, sort of brocade. You see his red with the, red coat with the fur collar. They're going for a touch of authenticity. So I'm going to ask a question since I think Jason froze. So if you see and this is something you see in a lot of the previews, it's this line about diplomacy and seduction.
Mm.
And it says, diplomacy must never be a siege, but a seduction. And this is getting all the play.
Yeah.
And Nelson and I actually had a Twitter conversation going back and forth on this because I said – I have heard this sort of repeated. I've seen like similar sentiments expressed on like, you know, the sort of the coffee cup, you know, founders sort of quotations or, you know, the spurious quotations. So did Franklin ever say anything like that? And if not, where does it come from?
I would argue he definitely said something like that. And it probably comes from the fact that in a similar way that all of his quotes from his Farmer's Almanac. Like, remember, all those quotes he didn't just say, it's these phrases he's heard throughout his life that he's generated. So I would honestly, even though I can't find personally the direct quote that's similar like that to Franklin. But I mean, I can see Franklin saying that.
Yeah.
So I won't lie. It's one of those things like almost organically, you can definitely attribute it to Franklin because he said certain things about this. I was curious, though, when I went through his papers on the digital archive, I was curious. I'm like, what does he say about seduction? A lot of it comes up in specifically related to politics, and it's dancing around those themes. So while I can't find the original quote, I'm pretty sure the writers for the Franklin miniseries pulled from the line that Tom Wilkinson's character says in that John Adams miniseries, where he says, seduction by, it's a seduction by another name, but in the series it says it should not be a siege, it should be a seduction, like that variation. But most likely they're just in general influence, like this sounds like something Franklin would say considering everything he is about. And so I won't lie, I'm comfortable kind of saying Franklin did say that, because that's no different than all the other quotes that we claim Franklin said that he's like collaborated into his Farmer's Almanac personally.
Yeah, I think it's probably conveying his sentiment.
It's rooted in truth. So
But again, I think we're looking for the most direct source. It's the John Adams miniseries. And the director, Tim Van Patten, said, I want to do something different from the John Adams miniseries. Well, his writers seem to want to kind of look to it for nods.
I won't lie. I think I like the Douglas variation more just because of the war theme. But that's just me.
All right, I want to ask you guys now, as we're kind of coming to a close here, we have so much more to talk about over this course the next several weeks. General thoughts now, if we're kind of summing up, how do we feel about this series, first three episodes, and what are we looking forward to as we move forward? Craig?
You can go first, Craig.
I missed the last part. I know. What do you think about this series? And then did you catch the last part?
I did not.
Where do you want to go? What are we looking for as we move forward?
Okay, so what I think about the series so far, first three episodes, I think are really great.
Yeah,
I think it's a really nice setup. I love that it's mostly filmed in Paris. It looks like it's mostly filmed in Paris. Mm-hmm. I like that it's low lit. It looks like candlelight. It's got the feel. It's not trying to be, you know, Marie Antoinette with Kirsten Dunst, where it's all brightly lit and pastels and playing punk music. It's not trying to be Amadeus, where everyone just speaks with their regular accent in English. It's different. It's not even like the Adams miniseries, which is really sort of brightly lit. It feels different. I think the setup is really good. I think it's doing a good job introducing the characters. Mm-hmm. It nods to the past, right? You've got the quoting of Franklin to himself. You've got like, you know, oh, look, they're playing the glass harmonica over in the corner. What's the glass harmonica? Oh, it's something I invented. But it doesn't go deep into the back. It's assuming some knowledge on the part of the viewer. Again, that maybe we'll see how it's received. That could be, these could just go over people's heads, or it could be these really, you know, pleasant, like, oh yeah, I knew about that. I think the involvement of prominent role of there are lots of women in this. I think that's great. Mm-hmm. I know the director and the cast read the book by Mon Cher Papa,
Claudette Lopez.
Claudette
and the Women of Paris.
Yeah, they absolutely read that. Women are apparent again. By and large, this is men negotiating, you know, in a back room, but it's showing that women are crucial, are involved, are present. I think it could do a better job, and this is something Kels has alluded to. I think they undersell the role of certain women and try to cast them as more potential love interest than was accurate. Mm-hmm. But just the fact that their presence is there, I think he does a good job of sort of world building, setting up Paris beyond Franklin, right? It's in some ways an ensemble cast.
Yeah.
That it's nominally about Franklin, but it's really about the building of this alliance. I think that is fantastic. The interesting thing is, and this is, and, you know, we've talked about this before on the podcast. The series is a lot of talking, a lot of sitting in rooms talking about stuff. And how long and how well is that going to hold the average audience member? So that's why I think it's smart to bring in Lafayette, but it also makes it a little less accurate. So Lafayette is sort of like your action hero. And whenever you need to show something in America, it's meanwhile in America, here's Lafayette. And it's like showing explosions at the Battle of Brandywine, because other than that, it's 79-year-old, you know, Ben Franklin sitting around talking about, you know, whatever, his skin conditions.
Yeah.
So I think that is one of the struggles the show is going to have. I've seen all the episodes, so I won't spoil it too much. I think that's one of the struggles, that there are going to be moments where it's really slow. And you're not going to, and I think sometimes the series is going to build up some creative drama when it feels that lull.
That makes sense. I kind of figured they were going to do that. I agree with Craig. I personally, because there's so much secrecy surrounding what Franklin is doing in France, I love that they're taking the creative licensing to show these private conversations and all this seedy backroom shit. I love that. Like, I was enthralled by it, because it's the things like I always like in my head, like imagine like what would these conversations have been, because we're historians, like we have to be rooted in the fact of what we're saying. But like, those are the conversations that how I would picture them having them. And I really, really like that. I don't hate that they're doing the Lafayette cutting scenes, specifically because, again, it's doing something that the series is doing very well, is you don't win the war without France. And Lafayette's a symbol of that over there. Like, we're seeing all the movement of arms and smuggling under the cover of night and everything with Beaumarchais, but seeing them in action is a lot easier if you have a Frenchman at the helm that you recognize. And Lafayette's very American in a lot of ways. You can't go into any state or town without a Lafayette Street, you know? So I personally think that's really smart. I don't think it detracts, especially if they're going to do this like little bit of cutaway. Because down the road, William Temple Franklin and Lafayette have a pretty decent back and forth. I actually don't know if it started this early, like they suggested in the series. My understanding is they became kind of close later in life. But I do like it, though, because it's kind of these two very, very smart writing. It's these two, like, diverging paths of these two young men coming of age story, while also, like, what Franklin's doing and the, like, again, the overall arching poignant thing that they're trying to get across. You do not win the war without French bullets. I was fascinated by how quickly they, like, brushed off Saratoga, though. I was like, what the fuck is this? Saratoga is the reason France comes into the war. Craig, when I saw that, I was like, what the fuck? Like my friends laughed at me. I'm like, no, you don't understand. You only win Saratoga because of what Dean did earlier. Those French guns and bullets are the only reason we win Saratoga.
Yeah, so this is
publicly comes in to support the war. I was like, this is all you're doing for Saratoga? It's really cool. Like, they have the pamphlet of the victory at Saratoga on the printers and stuff. But I was like, what is this? Freaking out about this.
Yeah, so they use it as sort of like as a cliffhanger. You know,
and they don't I'm gonna lose my shit.
Every episode sort of has this sort of cliffhanger where it'll be like words, letters.
Power.
Their power.
Well, and then it's fair, but.
And then, you know, episode three, it's like, you know, just meanwhile, like someone, it reminds me of Eddie Izzard, comedian Eddie Izzard has a bit about, you know, how basically Star Wars, if it was a British movie, it would just be people walking into rooms.
So, the rebels, what about it, Lieutenant Sebastian? They're here. Oh, that's Dash, cunning of them. There are these moments where, like with the Saratoga, where Franklin's just there, then a letter arrives and it's like, we have won Saratoga. Dun! You know, next time on Franklin.
The way they did it with mentioning I think they had to do that, right? Like, secret deal. I was like, what the fuck is this?
So let's talk about this, because the show, I admit, I was not personally aggrieved like Kelsa was, but let's talk about Saratoga, because the show really doesn't do it in that depth. So let's do it here.
Yes.
So Saratoga, if you don't know, is the site of a racetrack that won the American Revolution. It's a site of a very important battle in upstate New York. A series of battles, I should say. Again, the true historians will get mad at me. Well, you didn't specify between first Saratoga. What about Bemis Heights? Saratoga. So it's a battle in upstate New York. Why is it fought there? Well, it's basically, think big picture. For the British get really bad intel. And their intel is largely coming from various points, with Thomas Hutchinson, who was the former governor of Massachusetts, who gets run out after the Tea Party. And he's in London and he's telling anyone that'll listen, the Americans really aren't in rebellion. It's just those Adamses and those Sons of Liberty types. We have to go find, you know, we have your king's true loyal subjects are there. So the idea is, well, if you cut off Massachusetts, you cut the head off the snake, the rest of the rebellion will die. What's the easiest way to do that? Well, you go up the Hudson from New York while marching down from Canada. You cut off New England, war over. So this is a product of, you have a guy named Gentleman Johnny Burgoyne marching down from Canada. He's supposed to have reinforcements from New York. Doesn't happen. British generals don't necessarily get along with each other. Oh, Johnny, did you get lost in the woods? and such. So he's basically plodding along with a baggage train that includes champagne, where he's hosting dinner parties. His native allies are like, we're trekking through the woods in Patriot territory. We don't like this. They sort of desert him. And it's a battle that is won nominally by Horatio Gates.
Benedict Arnold will say he wins it single-handedly. Maybe he comes pretty close to doing it. So that's the one place in America you could see a statue of Benedict Arnold. It's the statue of the leg that he took a bullet in. So you can go see it. But why does this matter? It's a surrender of a major British army. And it's a major victory that Franklin and others can use to say, look, America can defeat the British. It's a something the French could latch on to and say, look, they actually can survive this. We're not just throwing our money, our soldiers, our navy in something, and it's we're not going to get anything of it. We're going to lose. There is some value here. Now, there is some contention. You have some historians more recently saying, well, France was looking to get in this war anyway, and this would have happened regardless. It just sped up the timetable. I'm not sure I agree with that.
I don't agree with that either, because they needed something significant to show that the Americans were committed to independence the entire time. And up until then, the Americans had only been winning through like these kind of backdoor routes of winning conflicts. They had not won a toe-to-toe battle.
Yeah.
Major battle. And this is like that, like they would not have gone publicly to support them had not there been something of the same level at Saratoga.
Yeah, if it's just sort of like, you know, Mel Gibson Patriot style, we hit run hide in some swamp somewhere. Yeah, that's not going to sell in Europe. That's not honorable. That's not.
Yeah,
it's this traditional European-esque victory. So I agree with Kelsa that this is so crucial. Without Saratoga, maybe, you know, there's some other elements of contingencies. Maybe something else happens. But this is the moment that really triggers and allows the alliance to happen. The alliance is going to be the alliance of 1778, obviously. Mm-hmm. But it's really that fall in Saratoga 1777 that is going to give Franklin the ammunition to get ammunition.
Yeah, I fully agree. The only thing I would say that the timetable moves up is specifically for Vergennes, because the entire time throughout, in between every major conflict between France and England, France demilitarizes their navy. So one of the things that Vergennes the entire time is trying to build up a navy again. So the only timetable that actually gets pushed up is actually declaring war with not the amount of number of ships that Vergennes would prefer to have before open conflict. But Vergennes even knows, like, no, this is the moment to push forward, because if we wait to try to do another one, it might be too late. Because they're already seeing, like, secret aid already, like, this is probably the best that secret aid is going to be able to do. But otherwise, like, no, France is not going to get involved unless there is a huge public victory where the Americans head-on beat the British, where they can show that they're committed to independence and they're not going to just fall by the wayside over these small little victories. Small little victories don't equal long-term support. Like, again, the same thing is happening with them. It's much easier to commit and fight for a war that you actually support. If you're not having good victories, it's hard to want to support a war. Why else would we support our families and friends and brothers and dying if there's no, like, nothing to show for it? So Saratoga is the moment that France can publicly come in and support the American war effort. And that's what makes it such a big deal.
So what Kelsa's basically admitted is the battlefield influences the diplomacy.
It's only
George
one
Washington.
With French bullets.
Those George French Washington, bullets. Greater than Ben Franklin.
All the war rages on. I was wondering why Apple gave us three episodes to start with. And then I realized, okay, they had to get to Saratoga for us to get going. So speaking of getting going, we've been going almost now for 2 hours. We have many more episodes to go. Craig Brewsmith, Kelsa Pelletier, E-A-I-O-U. I don't know how the Italians do it. Guys, thank you so very, very much for being here today. It works.
It's fine. No, Jason, like it's honestly fine. It's honestly fine.
And
no
diplomacy.
One gets it right. My students call me Mrs. P. It's fine.
Fair enough. All right, guys. Hold on. All right, everybody. Hey, so thank you so very much for being here, for listening to this pod, for this episode of the Ben Franklin series of Franklin. We've got a whole bunch of other folks coming for the next few weeks, so keep coming back. We're going to have new episodes for you every single Monday. And we'll see you a little bit later. Ciao for now. Bye.